Blog Talk Radio.
Much cheaper than a priceless plan. But promises can disappear just on writing in the sand. Treaty, yeah. Treaty now. Treaty, yeah. Treaty now. Given up. This land was never bought and sold. The planting of the Union Jack never changed our law at all. Now the rivers run their course, separated for so long. I'm dreaming of a brighter day when the waters will be won.
That was Yothu Yindi with the original version of Treaty from back in 1991. You've joined a team of voices on Blog Talk Radio for the Australia Day special. It is Australia Day here as I'm broadcasting in Melbourne. And while I am here, I should respectfully acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land I'm on, the Bunurong Boon Wurrung and the Wurundjeri Wurrung peoples of the Eastern Kulin Nation, and pay respect to elders past, present and emerging. Now that I've done that, I'm going to welcome my co-hosts for tonight, and they are none other than Jay Hatter. Hello, Hatter. How are you?
Good morning, Epi.
Excellent. And also, none other than Deborah Lee. Thank you, Deb, for setting up the board and for getting all the stuff ready for the show tonight.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
So, it's it meant to be a holiday here, of course, a public holiday here in Australia, but that's fine if you don't have work in the United States. I actually spent the first 3 hours of today on the phone on the video conference to the United States. An untraditional start to a public holiday. It's interesting because there's a lot of talk out there at the minute about Australia Day, because Australia Day has been celebrated for the last 50 or 60 years anyway, and it's been celebrated on the anniversary of when the European ships came into Sydney and planted the English flag. Sort of fine if you're from a European heritage, but if you're one of the peoples who came from the 500 indigenous groups who were in the country at the time, you know, they see it much rather differently, and they would call it Survival Day or Invasion Day. And interestingly, the views of the Australian public on this matter have changed considerably in the last 15 years. And polls came out today that showed a clear majority of all Australians believe that it would be a wise and respectful move to shift Australia Day away from this day. And that's probably the first time I think I've seen that since I've been here, which is, I think, just a respectful thing to do, to be honest. So Australians actually believe that this day shouldn't be where it is now in a majority. And this all sort of started, this whole movement. If you go to the board, you'll see an image there under a team of voices, and the way to get to see this, if you're listening and want to see all this stuff down the track on the recording, is to knock on the door of a team of voices at allpoetry.com. It is free to join, and at the door you will find Deborah Lee, and hopefully we'll find a way to let you in. And if you look at on the board, you'll see a copy of a thing called the Barunga Statement, and that was from 1988. And that was when the Prime Minister at the time, Bob Hawke, went up to the Northern Territory and attended a great celebration of Aboriginal art and sport, the Barunga Festival, and leading Aboriginal people called the Barunga Statement that was actually printed on bark. And so half of it, or three quarters of it, was actually paintings, and the middle of it was the statement, which basically called for recognition of Aboriginal peoples and a fair and equitable settlement of what had happened with Aboriginal peoples since 1788. And Bob Hawke took that away, and he said, I think we can work with this and we'll have something in a year. And the Song Treaty was released 3 years after that exchange of documents, and there still wasn't a treaty in sight. And we come now with 20, 30 years later, and there's still no treaty. So we haven't really gone forwards. And the Barunga Statement ended up in a frame in Parliament House, which sort of seems really kind of strange that a sort of protest document that had a series of claims would end up in the place where it should have been decided that those claims would be seen, and it still hasn't happened.
There's nothing at risk. Yeah.
Not really. I don't know. I mean, just the fact that, you know, that at the end of the day, I think that if you're a mature, grown-up nation, you should be able to find a way to reach a settlement with the peoples that were here when you came along and invaded, effectively.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I don't believe ignoring or just not paying attention to a celebrated day is the answer either. I think more.
No. I mean, you should change that anyway, to be honest. I mean, because it offends, you know, part of your community, and so if it offends part of your community, you shouldn't do it. Yeah, but I just think, you know, as I said, in a mature, grown-up country, you have a relationship with the peoples, the indigenous peoples that were there before you, and you do that on the basis of a fair and reasonable and equitable settlement, which never happened and still hasn't happened in Australia. So, anyways, so there you go. And I guess a treaty, the song that we heard, which came out 3 years after, was basically written by the same people who wrote the Barunga Statement, except they got a couple of friends along the way. They got a very famous Australian songwriter called Paul Kelly to help, and then they flipped around the corner to another famous songwriter called Peter Garrett, of Midnight Oil, who put his 2 cents worth in. So Peter Garrett's also listed as a songwriter. And the interesting thing, of course, is that Peter Garrett put his song in Midnight Oil and his songs to one side for about 5 years and was a minister of the Australian Parliament. He was the Minister for the Environment for that period of time. So there you go. That's the and that's the sort of links and connections there, and that's why I thought it'd be worth putting that Barunga Statement on the board, and why it's important that we keep on remembering that is there, because it as I said, it sits in Parliament House. Oh, who's that? Is that you, Hannah?
That was me, yeah. Sorry, it was a buzzer.
Yeah, it was a buzzer.
Yeah, it looked like there were three different main feelings on celebration of Australia Day when I went looking.
Yes.
Does it seem like it comes around and it gets rewashed every so often, every decade, or every sort of recycles through
A little bit, although I think it's probably been building, I think, over time, Adam. I think the, you know, that really, if you talk to anybody probably under the age of 15, they'd say that Australia Day is an anachronism and it's embarrassing.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seemed to me that was there a salary of an Aboriginal athlete that sparked...
Look, there's been a series of events, whether it's been, you know, the 2000 Olympics, whether it's been 1988 was the biggest, the bicentenary, 200 years after the Europeans got to Australia. Probably the most likely, to be honest, that there was a chance to get a treaty, because Bob Hawke was a really interesting prime minister. He was somebody who changed the status quo. He was somebody who, you know, put in place the pensions and retirement income system that we have in Australia. He floated the dollar. He did a whole heap of really interesting long-term strategic initiatives. And probably, if we had any chance, it was when Bob Hawke was Prime Minister. The problem was, of course, that there's only so much you can do, he I think probably ran out of time, not intent, but probably ran out of time. Bob Hawke, of course, being, you know, well known as the third longest serving prime minister, but he was also known for and the only prime minister that was born in South Australia and educated in Western Australia to become the Prime Minister of Australia. But that's not what he was known for. Actually held a famous record in Australia. Do you know what that was?
Slamming a beer.
That's the one. That's the one.
I think I remember that.
Right. That's absolutely right.
I was going to ask you, didn't you talk about Bob Hawke before on one of your shows?
I did, and Bob Hawke died at the sort of reasonably sort of young age of what? How old was he? 89, yeah? Even within a year of his death, he was still slamming down beers at the cricket. a pint of beer in one go. And you know, as I said, within that time, and he did the record in England. It's worth noting, because he was a Rhodes Scholar. He got a scholarship to Oxford University in 1953. In 1954, in one go, he sculled 1.4 litres or 2.5 pints of beer in world record time, Hatter.
Two and a half pints,
1.4 litres of beer. And do you know what that time was?
Cool. Now, what was it?
6 seconds.
11 seconds. 11 cool. seconds he took to scull 2.5 pints of beer.
Wow.
That's wicked.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah, you've got to have some sort of system to do that. But anyway, that was his record. He held that record for quite a while, actually, because it's a fairly decent record to try and beat. But he, as I said, he was an interesting character. He only passed away a couple of years ago, and there was, in his farewell ceremony, there was considerable Indigenous components. So anyway, there you go.
Now, did you say he had the title? Did someone actually beat that?
Oh, yeah. Somebody's beaten it. Yeah, no. He doesn't hold it now.
Yeah.
That was just good for an old guy.
Just open your throat and pour it down.
Well, that's exactly right. He probably held the senior record.
Yeah.
You know, and there is a thing about beer and Australians. Now, it's a lot less than what it was, okay? But to give you an example, sportsmen in particular, had a thing about beer. And so the record for consuming cans of beer, 375ml cans, from Sydney to London was held by an Australian cricketer, David Boone. And that's about how far long is the flight? It's about a 15-hour flight, 14, 15-hour flight. Do you know what the record was, Hatter, that he set?
No, I don't. I can't imagine.
52 cans of beer in the one flight.
15 hours, 52?
15 hours, 52 full cans of beer.
Could
amazing.
He walk afterwards?
No, I think he needed help, Jeff. In all seriousness, you have that much beer, you know, you get yourself into all sorts of trouble, you know, especially when you try and stand up. But I guess I should read a poem. And once upon a time, when Australians came together as Australia, which was only 1900, it's fair to say, so it wasn't that long ago, because we were all states before then. As Australia, we had a World War One come about, and Banjo Paterson was writing at the time, and he wrote a poem called "We're All Australians Now" and put it in the newspaper. I've reprised it to a reprise of "We're All Australians Now." It's worth noting for the record that it actually includes the same end rhyme scheme all the way down. But anyway, apart from that, we'll go with the poem, "We're All Australians Now," from me from a little bit ago, and it goes a bit like this. A country battles upon a land, replacing a culture grew of genocide borders spanned without respect or treaty to. Over beaches near the setting sun to the sands of an outback way, yet to recognise injustices done, so how can we stand today? Of hundreds of nations aligned, some language of dreaming runs, skirmishes with spear and drum against those firing guns. By battles all over the death's tour, as the invasion stressed, onwards the settlers full bore, this really was not a contest. Until those peoples left poured to the edges of lands not sown, they were removed from our core as remnants of history known. While they sit today in prisons nigh or depart too young on breeze, parts of ourselves lost in the way we slowly wither by degrees. Taken injustices to history accrued, combined reflections we craft, as terrible overseas events brew, can see the wheat from the chaff. Time to reach out and make it right. Deep inside we know how to finally settle upon a treaty. Then we can all be Australians now. End poem.
Boy.
I remember that.
It's just a matter of growing up, really. It's not that hard. You know, we all eventually grow up. And that's just something we've got to do as a country. And it's going to cost money, and it's going to cost time, and it's going to cost resources, and all of that should be reasonable and fair given the circumstances. So, let's just get on with it and do it. Anyway. I guess enough said about that. But as I said, let's just do it. And what's more, the people are starting to get to the point of saying that's what we should do. So, anyways.
Wait, you got a little comment. Like those last two stanzas. I'm sorry. Yeah, those last two stanzas still stand out. But since I heard it before, I got to more listen to the tone in your voice. And when you get to that part of it, to those last two stanzas, that the sound in your voice changes too. It's like, you know, all right, this is enough is enough. Let's just do this. But the most profound part is we can all be Australian now. It's just a really awesome poem.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Hannah.
Sorry, Hannah.
No, go ahead. I'm cutting my cows on.
We've talked about it for long enough. Let's just find the political will to go and do it. It may well be. I mean, we're about to have an election. We probably will see a change of political parties and. It's the Labor Party tends to be the party that actually does these things. So I'm just going to put one other poem in that's one of my favourites from years ago that you know very well, and that is this is a good example of where we're sort of undoing a lot of work that's been done because we're losing languages, we're losing words, and we're losing people who can speak these languages. And this particular language that's in this poem, is in Creole, has about 200 people or less that speak it. And actually trying to hear, you know, you've actually got to go into a library and hear cassette tapes to actually hear it spoken now. This is a sort of cry out to save those languages. And this is Langa, a crocodile, and it goes a little bit like this. Nkadia bin Kumuplanga Billabong, hunter with his spear, singing in song, looking to fish Barramundi to revive his fortune in these waters arrive. In crocodile bin Runlunga tree, hunter saw a crocodile lounging bee, each observing as reptile smiled, eons a visitor here in wild. Yukangaruban come up longer billabong. Crocodile watched move quickly along into a river, a wave surged into waters, deeper to strike in close quarters. Yukangaruban kaid longer crocodile. Strikes kangaroo is lost to his guile as the hunter has speared fish, both dinner, absent a dish, in poem.
Still amazes me the way you built through that language.
It's really interesting, Deb, because you've got to listen to the tapes to get the pronunciation right. The, you sort of throw the sound from the back of your voice. And so what that means is that the words sort of jump out, and they sort of flow into each other. So the hard edges of the letters sort of go, and it sort of becomes a sort of almost sing song. It hits a sort of pattern. I don't know how to describe it, but it just sort of hits a pattern if you're doing it right. And it's quite fast, but if you hit it, it just sounds quite distinct. So, but it was fascinating. I mean, I think it's one of the reasons I do poetry is to go and just investigate things and look at things and find things out. And originally, I was going to do the whole poem in Creole, and then about 2 days in, I recognised that was probably going to be a little bit hard. And so I just went with the one line in each of the four stanzas, and that was enough, you know. I wish I'd done more, but it was a really interesting use of time, just to see how few people spoke it and how few resources there were that people could work out how to speak it, if that makes sense.
Did you understand the words you said, or just learn to read them and say them, but sort of, how am I?
I understood them. Because the other thing is that the verb subject is a little different, and so and some words are the same, and some words are quite different. It was a really interesting thing to do. Oh, I'm glad I did.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. And to have it written there and be part of your profile is awesome, too. For 100 years from now, when people are thumbing through your page, they'll see that. It sort of gives it another paper trail. That's very cool.
Yeah, I've got a few sort of Indigenous-inspired sort of poems, and they're all kind of fun, really. I enjoy each of them in their own way. It's fun. Yeah, it's fun. And you know, we're slowly getting the our proverbial together. Like, for example, in one of the sporting codes in the rugby, we had the Australian national anthem sung in the Indigenous language of Sydney, which is from the Eora people, and it actually sounded really good, sounded really neat. So I suspect that will probably become the norm, which would be a good thing.
Pretty cool.
So. There was mass starving and there was disease and it really was an extinction of the highest and ugliest orders, really. It many would argue it goes on today with the amount of Indigenous folk in jails, the health outcomes for Indigenous people, that they've got terrible inclinations towards type 2 diabetes, and the minute you go to type 2 diabetes, of course you go to kidney failure, and there are hundreds of Indigenous people in Northern Australia that are reliant on dialysis machines, and they find it incredibly hard. It's just complete odds to their culture and how they go about things, and most don't do it for more than a couple of years, which is a real shame. So, and it, you know, there's a number, you can't actually say, there's a number of things about Aboriginal and Indigenous culture, and it, people that have passed in the last, I think it's the last 5 years, you can't say their names out loud. So there was a very famous Indigenous singer who passed as a result of just deciding that they couldn't do the dialysis process anymore. And that's just a real shame. It's a shame that they got the thing in the first place, but it's just terrible that they make the decision not to keep going. But I think I've said to you both before that the outcome of that, though, is that if you're somebody like myself who relies on a dialysis machine to keep on going, you need to, in order to go to the Northern Territory, in order to go to Darwin or Alice Springs and see Uluru and see all these wonderful things, you've got to have somewhere you can dialyze every couple of days. And there are actually no dialysis positions free in the Northern Territory because that nobody knows when people are going to dialyze. And so I can't actually go to the Northern Territory because I can't dialyze there.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that's sort of strange, really, but it's the truth. It's actually, I've travelled around the world. I've travelled to, you know, 15 countries and dialysed in 15 countries, dialysed in Beijing, in Hong Kong, in Kuala Lumpur, in Singapore, all over the United States, in France, in Great Britain, in Scotland. But unfortunately, I can't go to the Northern Territory. So it's a sad thing, but that's the truth, unfortunately.
And obviously, it's not a day trip kind of place where you could hit and run.
It's not really, no, Deb. No, it's about, you know, from Melbourne to get to Darwin, it's about a 6-hour flight. And to get to, you know, if you were to dialyze somewhere else, probably the closest place you could go to would be Cairns. And that's about a 3.5-hour flight from Darwin. So I would need to hop a 3.5-hour flight there.
There and
back.
I don't know that I would
every
either.
Day.
Yeah, so, well, I don't.
It's a fairly significant,
I don't think I would risk it either because there's a weather delay or something. It messes with you more.
Well,
than...
that's true. That is true. You do get. You know, it's pretty stormy. It's tropical weather up there. You can get caught. You'd want to be pretty careful. So, anyways, so there you go. That's my sort of story, personal medical story about the fact that about how the impact of this issue has become so broad in the local Indigenous communities in the Northern Territory.
Let me get this straight. There's no way of being dialyzed up there because you don't know when the times are right. Or is it because they are restricting it because somebody, a class of people, need it?
Local Indigenous people don't follow the timetables they're given, Hatter. They show up or not. And so because in the rest of the country, the reason you get a space is because you've got four machines and you know three people are timetabled to show up at that time and there's one free. But if you give everybody timetables and they don't follow them, then you don't know whether you've got a free machine or not.
Yeah. Well.
And that's the truth of the matter. Well, that's what happens. So, it's a strange one.
Is there another Aboriginal people somewhere in the world that has the same kind of a thing? I mean, I know you're
really
in Indonesia.
I don't know. I think there's something about the particular diet and the way that it interacts with the way that Indigenous people are here that causes diabetes. The diabetes in Indigenous people here is just a huge issue. I know it's the same in some of the Pacific Islands, by the way, in Tonga and some of those sort of places, but there's far more Indigenous people here up north than there is in other locations. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there's four times more likely to get diabetes than Indigenous folk are four times more likely to get diabetes than non-Indigenous Australians.
And that's because of the diet?
Yeah, it's the diet, and I think it's also because of the way they process food and what they used to eat and all that sort of stuff. So,
they're planting seeds for the thing to go wrong years ago. Figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a long term issue, and but again, you know, I think the local Indigenous leaders would say, well, look, if we got a treaty and we put some stuff together and we put programs together and we ran them ourselves, reducing the prevalence of this, and I think they're probably right.
So is the problem basically the joining of the two social differences?
Yeah, and poor nutrition, though, Hatter. Poor nutrition too. Poor choices. You know, like as with many, you know, communities, the cheapest food is not necessarily the best food for you. And so, if you don't have a lot of money, and therefore you buy the cheapest food, therefore you get worse health outcomes, and therefore you get sick.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, it's not an outcome that anybody wants, but it's an outcome that tends to happen because, you know, there's not a lot of money, and so people buy the cheapest stuff, and in buying the cheapest stuff, they create other health outcomes. Yeah. One thing I was involved in, and at the very start of, back in my years ago, was that there was a huge issue with Indigenous communities in the outback sniffing petrol. They would actually sniff it for a high, and they'd use the aromatics that were coming off the fuel. And my old company actually went and spent a lot of time and effort creating a fuel that didn't have aromatic in it. And so it was specifically designed for the Indigenous communities because you couldn't sniff it. It was called Opal. The fuel was called Opal.
That's fascinating.
It's still supplied today to communities, to Aboriginal outback communities, and it's the only fuel that has, to my knowledge, ever been produced that doesn't have an aromatic high to it. So it's specifically blended so that you can't get a high from sniffing the petrol. So it's an interesting sort of piece of engineering work that went into that to create something that that creates less harm. So anyway, it was, I certainly wasn't involved when it was launched. I was involved in the early stages of its creation. But there were many, many people involved in getting that right. And it's still, as I said, still produced today, 20 years on. So it was at least that was some positive. But there are a series of issues out there. And sorry, Hannah?
So it's including the Aboriginal people and their social network in cities or in towns, mm. whatever. Are they? Is it involve losing seats in Parliament, giving power to something you don't want them to have power from? Is that to go into that realm?
I think it's actually more about money, Hatto, to be honest. I think that the issue is not so much about setting up appropriate representation or having appropriate recognition in words of what's gone wrong. I think it's about the recompense, to be honest. And it's most things break down when it comes to money.
Yeah, disguised as race. A lot of times they just disguise it in race a bit all the damn time.
You can disguise it however you like, yeah. But I think it's actually about money. And at the end of the day, I think you know, there's a considerable sum of money that needs to be handed over. But I think most Australians would believe that's only fair. So. But,
yeah, it sounds to me like it's one of those where the silent majority or the silent minority has more power or less power than it requires. Because two different ways to look at it. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, I think it's one of those issues that's sort of been simmering around for a number of years, and I think it's been in an issue that most Australians have struggled with and have now sort of reconciled themselves to the fact that it's needed and it needs to be done. So I think that's the difference in the last few years. I think a majority of Australians have worked out that's what needs to happen and that, you know, we need to sort it out.
Yeah, there's still, I remember, there's still parts of our society here in the States where the generation ahead of us viewed race and interaction with a whole different way. I mean, not that they were right or wrong.
Yeah, sure.
Not that they were right or wrong. They were following the norm.
No, they're just different. And it goes both ways. And you know, society's attitudes on things, you know, move and change as they should. I would argue as poets, you know, we reflect upon society, and it's important for us to be holding a view on that, you know, and publishing a view on that, you know, because I think it's important.
Yeah, my point was too, was it can be disguised in a whole different array of issues when it all comes back to, like you said, it comes back to money. They'll throw anything in there just to cloud the water so you can't see it. Yeah.
Yeah, it comes back to money. So I was gonna put I don't know whether you've heard this one, Hatter. I you may not have. This is I really liked this poem because it's an Australian sort of centric poem, but it also has what I think is a really good rhyme scheme. So I want you to take account of the rhyme scheme. This is Southern Cross, and it goes a little bit like this. The sands they did curl ochre red until skies filled with star bands, and his smile widely spread as the light danced in strands. Butter moon and nebula blue danced across heavens to stutter, utter reverence to dreaming too in the night's far distant clutter. Pole five orbs, Southern Cross, guiding a path to a distant knoll, toll the rusting windmills across the fields, a desert my whole. Glove of creation loops hope by those spirits held seek love. Above forefathers do elope with hopes and dreams thereof. Afar and near these skies tie a bright promise of who we are. Far I'm away, Christmas nigh, drawn beyond wishes, stars, in comp.
Hmm. if you're standing where you are right now and you're facing the Southern Cross, which direction are you facing?
The southern the cross is elongated. The long part of the cross is elongated. Yeah. And so if you look at the Southern Cross, the long point of the star that's downward is pointing to the south, and the top one is pointing to the north.
But are you facing more south in the sky looking at it, or are you more in the
When I face it, I'm usually facing towards the north. Yeah.
North, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I do, as I said, I do like that rhyme pattern in that little ditty, because it has the four inner rhymes for the one and then the two rhymes for the other. And so you've got the six rhyming words, which I kind of like. So, you know, if you're into that.
Yeah, I'm into all sorts of foreign poetry.
Yeah, I think the rhyme pattern's awesome. The flow. I don't know how I missed this one. And I have a question about the art, too. Is that something that you have, or is it just Bob Cooper, Under the Southern Cross. It's very interesting. Got a Van Gogh kind of feel from reading.
Yeah, it's a European take on a Aboriginal style or an Indigenous style, and so it's kind of different. I don't mind it.
Looks like Peter Max went dots.
Yes. So I kind of thought it was fun. You know, but that's just me.
So I have a question about the moving of the date. I see that in a couple of different locations. I found one of the choices as May 9th. I believe it has something to do with Parliament or.
Yeah, when it first started, yeah.
I'm wondering, is there other dates? And if so, why? Like, are you going on that?
I mean,
or are you taking a poll on that as well?
I think you just choose one. I mean, for example, Australia started as a country on the 1st of January 1900. So why wouldn't you have Australia Day on the 1st of January, which was when the thing started in the first place. Because up until that day, each of the states had their own individual setup. And so you had the state of Victoria, the state of New South Wales, the state of South Australia, the state of Queensland, the state of Western Australia, And each of those individual states had their own houses of parliament, and they even had their own military. And so in the Boer War, for example, Australia didn't fight in the Boer War, but Victoria did, and South Australia did, and New South Wales did.
Damn.
Yeah. So, just moving that whole conversation on for a tick, there was always this great rivalry between Melbourne and Sydney. And so when the two, you know, when Australia came together in 1900, there was great debate about where the capital city should be. Should it be Melbourne or Sydney? And so they came up with a compromise, which was they let Melbourne be the capital city for the first 20-odd years while they built a new city just down the road from Sydney called Canberra. And that's how Canberra came to be.
How long did that take?
Oh, 20-odd years. It was only sheep and grass there. Some would argue there's only sheep and grass there now. But there was only sheep and grass there, Adam, and started to build stuff, you know.
Yeah. Can't wait till this road is done. I'll show them.
Yeah, exactly.
And were, so, and were they, you know, so who were the leaders of each, Victoria and such, what were the leaders called? Were they senators or were they czars?
Well, they,
or?
They were the premiers. They were the premiers of each state. We still have premiers of each state. And then we have a prime minister who's in charge of Australia. Yeah, premiers. Yeah. So they're a bit like governors in the US setup, except each state has a bit more power than the states do in the United States.
But you don't have lords and dukes and all this different.
Christ, no! Thank God for that. No. We don't have any titled people.
Class level. Titles.
Well, we do have classes, but thank God we don't have titled classes like the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
We don't have dukes and duchesses and lords and whatever.
It's like lords or landowners, right? Lords were landowners and
yes, they were. Yes, privileged landowners. What's more, yes. So, but of course, you know, we did have a lot of English intersection in Australian laws for a good 100-odd years because most of the people who came out here came from England, yeah.
Must have been a hell of a try. Let's go to Australia, the other side of the planet.
The Australians were very good at marketing themselves. So, for example, when things were really tough in England and in Europe at the end of World War II, they offered they basically offered for £5 or, you know, $10, you could get on a ship and come to Australia and start again. And they used to call them £5 POMs, POM being an American, a Brit. And my father was one of those. He came out when he was 13 on a boat from England to Australia and started in Australia again, afresh, with his family.
13, wow.
Wave as you go 13. By. Yeah.
You're not able... So I can't remember how long since he said the voyage was, but I think he said it was something like 4 or 5 weeks. Because you basically have to go down around the Horn of Africa and then across the Indian Ocean.
You do have the Gulf Stream. Yeah, you do have the Gulf Stream working for you.
Well, I probably do, but even still, it's a fairly decent voyage.
Oh, yeah. Oh, hell yeah.
But there were thousands of people who made that voyage. And then more recently, you know, when we had the Vietnam War, we had, you know, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese people come to Australia in boats to escape what was going on there. So, you know, we've had a number of different, you know, groups of migrants come to Australia in, you know, different, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, political times.
And Australia's got a like America. You know, America's always been a magnet for different people coming in from different countries. For Australia, in the last year, the top eight countries that the most permanent migrants came from. Do you want to guess which one was the top, Hatter, by the way?
In what era or what timeline do you mean, recently?
In the last year. Country had the most permanent migrants to Australia?
Let's see. How far up does that go? I don't know. I'm totally guessing.
Yep. You want to take a guess?
I really don't. Let's go.
Okay.
I don't think there's any South Africa. West Africa.
South Africa is not in the top eight. Deb, did you want to have a guess about what country might be in the top eight?
I was trying to picture around you, like country, New Zealand maybe.
New Zealand is number seven. Well done, Deb. New Zealand is number seven. Well done.
Oh, okay.
But
just Polynesia.
Just to give you an idea, sorry, Hannah?
New Guinea.
No, but it's a good guess, but no, because they're close, but no. The
and Tasmania is
numbers,
part of Oz, right?
Tasmania.
Yeah,
Tasmania
is off that
by numbers.
Coast.
Yeah, by numbers, the biggest permanent migration country to Australia in the last year was India.
Wow.
Ah.
So, and the top eight are India, China, the United Kingdom, Philippines, Vietnam, Nepal, New Zealand, and Pakistan.
Wow, and they're all trekking to Australia. That's pretty cool. Talk about diversity.
And what's interesting about that list is that my my medical helper, nurse, is from Nepal. She's one of those permanent residents who've come out to live in Australia. You wouldn't think Nepal would be in the top eight. It's not a very big country. But they do significant training of medical staff. And so a lot of medical staff come from Nepal to Australia and oftentimes send a lot of money home as well. So and Nepal is a very poor country, and a lot of people get very well trained in Nepal and then come out here and earn very good money as medical staff. So, and that's with my helper Indira. That's where she's from. So, she feels the heat, Hatter, I have to say, when it gets really hot like it is at the minute. If you're from Nepal,
yeah,
let me tell you, you know, it gets to 90, you start to really feel the heat. 4 or 5 days in a row, and you really feel the heat. So, it gives you really interesting sort of groups of people, and it's good for the diversity of the place, and it's interesting. So there you go. That's who are coming to Australia.
I'm trying.
So I probably should put another poem in. And I was thinking of going with one of my old favourites, Deb. So, and I was then probably going to do one more, and then probably call it a night, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, this is one of my favourites. I don't get it out that often because it's rebirth, but this is Kookaburra, and it goes a bit like this. Eucalypt and wattle once tangled upon this rocky slope. Faintly a lilt of forgotten stream washes, tinkling over moss-encrusted rocks, slippery to touch. The hover of a mist shimmies past on the whiff of a lolling breeze. Now relocated down the road next to the tar-reinforced overpass, with a worn body, the marks of needles and blades, long discarded, sweet powder lost in refuse and the leaching brown stain of gutter mines. Tomorrow is planned with block demolitions and relocations. New formations are eaten away by the air and flows that sustained the same courses for centuries. Water's tune has passed to the memory of trains clattering rails and the rev of an accelerated engine raging blue mists. The swirl of lives becomes a staccato of Twitter messages, a phone swish of reminders and Facebook updates. There are no grand themes or returning notes in pining refrains, replaced by the ill-defined spray of thought bullets. They shred trees, the brass bullets taking no prisoners and asking no questions, shining metals beat and tame the living. Earth and its retinue lie without a retort. The new contraptions are comedians, but nobody gave the world a program to discover the parts where we last. Bolts of lightning, a spray of a tsunami, and a dying reef do not a coordinated response make. We don't understand the gestalt. One cannot interpret a joke. From the tops of the trees can see the glitter of a bay shoreline, the rainbow created by shadows trails away to the distant waters. On the uppermost branch inside of the coast, a stubby and heavy bird sits. There is a rhythmic banging as hammer on nail. It is killing a snake by flaying it on a tree trunk. Its meal is old, the kookaburra chatters at length to an extended laugh. His navy plumage reflects water, his mottled beak gum trees, and his guffaw the pigments, gracing the future sky. End poem.
I know, I love that word. I looked them
which
up.
One, the, which word?
The kookaburra. I looked it up.
Oh, the kookaburra. Oh, I love kookaburras.
I love the word, too. I don't know why. I just love that word. But this had great visuals and rhyme and everything. It was like the total package. But it within listening to you in your rhyme and flow, you also take us on a trip and teach us about quite a few things, because I think I remember asking you about something else too. Trying to see what it was. I had never heard it before. Maybe this isn't the one I was thinking of. But still, like I said, it's got really awesome rhyme in it, but the big-time visuals, like blue mist and
oh, yeah. It's colorful.
Yeah, and towards the end, the navy plumage, I mean, it was just really gorgeous vision all through.
Can I play the kookaburra laughing?
Yeah, yeah.
Hopefully it comes through on them. Just let me see if you can hear it. Just so. Distinctive, isn't it?
Yeah, I was just thinking, imagine trying to sleep with that bugger.
Oh, no, they're loud. That was two of them together, but they're loud, and they're big, stumpy birds, and they're just strong and loud, and, you know, you've got to love kookaburras. So,
very, very cool.
There you go.
Now, so, I have a question. So, are they near you? Do you hear them, like, out your window, or are they more on the outskirts?
No, I can see kookaburras. I actually had a kookaburra at my old house about 5 miles, or 3 miles away, actually doing exactly that, what I described, that I heard the thumping, and it was literally like a hammer banging a nail. It was that rhythmic. I thought, this is going on for a long time. And I went back out and out the back, and there was a kookaburra just banging this snake side to side against the fence, you know, and completely rhythmically like a nail and a hammer.
Wow.
Now, the kookaburra, that is the sound that Hollywood did any favors. Anytime they're in the Amazon or the Africa, they hear that sound, they play that bird, and they're it's not native to either one.
No. They love the sound. Oh, yes, I do. They love the sound.
Yeah.
It's definitely a kookaburra. It's definitely Australian. So it's good fun. And there's something about a kookaburra that just sort of represents Australia really well. And I don't know why, but it's just.
Excuse me.
So I've got, Hannah, you've got one up on the board.
Yeah, but I got no eyes. My eyes just went.
Oh, did you want me to read it then?
Yeah, or Deborah, either one.
Yeah. Did you want me to read it or did you read it?
Yeah, go right ahead. Go right ahead.
All right, go ahead. Okay. Well, this is Aussie Skies from Hatter from from a few years ago, and it goes a little bit like this. Abby's strokes on hemp-soaked stones drying in the sun, splashing down without a sound, fooling everyone. Mutton trails and canvas sails from here to under there. Abby's walk with an outer net holding a blank-like stare. Circles form in random thoughts waiting for blistered skies, dawn to dusk in such a rush, not pretending to even try. Ancient ways hold darkened days, a king without a war, lines too long as if by song it says that they don't care. Donning sparks that blind your eyes, worn to weigh them down, flying under amidst the thunder, crashing to the ground. Colours press against the wind, gathered to blow away, roads that shine as if designed to walk but ne'er to stay. Infant crawls against the walls, whimpered suits of sails to buy, hidden graves stand to wave and thoughtful ways to die. A plan to steal in 4-inch heels, the shadows will always win, standing back to wait for time, knowing it's never been. In poem. I like some bits here, Hatter. I do. I like some bits. Colours press against the wind gathered to blow away. That's absolutely right. The further you get out, the more the colours just get washed. And it's not watercolour, but it's just washed. And roads that shine as if designed to walk but ne'er to stay. And that's correct too, because the roads eventually do get blown away unless they're fixed. Bit by bit, the sort of sand and the wind and stuff just eats away at them and, you know, rips them apart unless you do work to them, which is why, you know, you've only got a few major highways crossing large because it's just too hard to keep the roads in one piece. So there's and hidden graves stand to wave in thoughtful ways to die. There's all sorts of ways you can die in Australia, and there's only two or three ways you can live. And so it's kind of a nice way to describe it, Hatter.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. There's plenty of ways to die, so.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. There is. Choose your poison. You know, I mean, it was really... I've got a great story on this, Hatter. Yeah? I've got a great story on this. In my business in the United States, we've got a senior guy, and he has gone and climbed the highest mountains in each of the countries he has visited, yeah? And you know, he's been to the U.S., he's climbed the high mountains in the U.S., he's gone to Alaska, he's gone to France, he's gone to Germany, he's climbed incredibly high mountains. Anyway, so he came to Australia, and he had a day, and he thought, no, stuff it, I'm going to climb the highest mountain in Australia. And it's only tiny, and so apropos nothing else, he got in the car, and he drove 7 hours, and he went to this mountain, and he started climbing it. And it's only very small, Mount Kosciuszko, not a big mountain. But he was woefully underprepared, and he got into whiteout conditions. He couldn't see where he was going, and he didn't have very much stuff with him, and he got really cold. And he got the closest to dying he's ever been on the smallest mountain he's ever been on because he wasn't very prepared. And Australia has this funny way of finding you out, Hatter. Even if things aren't very big and not very cold and not very high, it still will kill you. And it just sort of has a way to do it. I don't know how to describe it. But he found it out in a big way because it took him a couple of weeks to get himself back together again after almost dying on Mount Kosciuszko when he'd gone up mountains three times as big. Anyway, former Navy SEAL, nice guy, by the way, former Navy SEAL, a very, very clever guy, but he got found out by Matt Kosciuszko. So, Deb, I am,
I am. Did you want to comment on Hatter's poem? And then I will do my last poem.
Okay. Yes, I can do that. And can you peek at your inbox too?
Yes.
But Hatter, I like the wording here, and I noticed that it was during a time when you were still put in shadow in almost every poem that you wrote. Circles form in random thoughts, waiting for blistered skies, dawn to such a rush, not pretending to even try. Mega amazing flow there. The rhyme scheme, the lines that scream, Hatter wrote this because it's got that. It's like each line itself has got a musical, lyrical feel. And sometimes when you go back further and pull some of these out, I feel like you were flowing freer with your pen then. I think you've become hypercritical of yourself, and when you're not second-guessing what you write, it's more awesome, and this is one of those. And I love the little note at the bottom for 8 show Tuesday, September 12, 2017. That was a couple of years ago.
Couple of years,
really,
yeah.
Cool.
What?
Yeah.
Another radio team, too. Awesome share, Hatter.
Yeah.
I love the picture.
So, okay. So I did read my emails, Deb. So I'm just going to go and see if I can find the poem that you got me to read the other day, a few months ago, because I really like that poem. I'm just trying to remember its name now, because you sent it to me and I'd never read it before. The really interesting thing for me was that it actually led on to the man from Snowy River. And so this is, and I have found it now, this is Pardon, Son of Reprieve. This is Pardon, Son of Reprieve by Van Gogh Patterson.
Melbourne Cup.
Actually, love this poem. And
me too.
It goes, "You never heard tell the story, well now I can hardly believe, never heard of the honour and glory of Pardon, the Son of Reprieve. But maybe you're only a johnny and don't know a horse from a hoe. Well, don't get angry, my sonny, but really a young'un should know. They bred him out the back on the never, his mother was Mamaluka breed, to the front and then stay there was ever, the root of the Mamaluka creed. He seemed to inherit their wiry strong frames and their pluck to receive, as hard as flint and as fiery, was Pardon, the Son of Reprieve. We ram him at many a meeting, at crossing and gully and town, and nothing could give him a beating, at least when our money was down. For weight wouldn't stop him, nor distance, nor odds, though the others were fast. He'd race with a dogged persistence, and wear them all down at the last. At the Turon, the Yattendon filly, led by lengths at the mile and a half, and we all began to look silly, while our crowd was starting to laugh. But the old horse came faster and faster, his pluck took its tail and his strength. He gained on her quarter and passed her, and won it, hands down, by a length. And then we swooped down on Menindi, to run for the President's Cup. Oh, that's the sweet township of Shindy, to them it's board, lodging and sup. Eye open as they are in their system, it's never to suffer defeat. It's wind tire wrangle to beat them. You must lose them or else it's dead heat. We strolled down the township and found them, but drinking and gaming and play, the sorrows they had while they drowned them, and betting was soon underway. Their horses were goodens and fittens, there was plenty of cash in the town. They backed their own horses like Britons, and Lord, how we wrapped it down. With gladness we thought of the morrow, we counted our wages with glee, a simile homily to borrow, there was plenty of milk in our tea. You see, we were green and we were never had even a thought of foul play, though we well might have known that the clever division would put us away. Experience, Gossett, they tell us, at least frequently I've heard, that dosing or stuffing those fellows were up to each move on the board. They got to his stall at a sinful to think what such villains would do, and gave him a regular skinful of barley, green barley, to chew. He munched it all night and we found him next morning as full as a hog. The girths wouldn't neat mirror around him and he looked like an overfed frog. We saw we were done like a dinner. The odds were 1,000 to 1 against Pardon turning up winner. It was cruel to ask him to run. We got to the course with our troubles. A crestfallen couple were we, and we heard the books calling the doubles a roar like the surf of the sea. And over the tumult and louder rang any price Pardon I lay. Says Jimmy, the children of Judah are out on the warpath today. 3 miles and 3 heats are my sonny. The horses in those days were stout. They had to run well to win money. I don't see such horses about. Your 6-furlong vermin that scamper 1/2 mile with their featherweight up, they wouldn't earn much of their damper in a race like the President's Cup. The first heat was soon set a-going. The dancer went off at the front. The don on his quarters was showing with Pardon right out of the hunt. He rolled, he weltered and wallowed. You'd kick your hat faster, I'll bet. They finished all bunched and he followed, all lathered and dripping with sweat. The troubles came thicker upon us, for while we were rubbing him dry, the stewards came over to warn us, we hear you are running a bye. If Pardon don't spiel like tarnation and win the next heat if he can, he'll earn a disqualification. Just think that over now, my man. Our money all gone and our credit, and our horse couldn't gallop a yard. And then people thought that we did it. It really was terribly hard. We were objects of mirth and derision to folk in the lawn and the stand, and the yells of the clever division of any price Pardon were grand. We still had a chance for the money. 2 heats remained to be run. It felt for both of us why my sonny, the clever division were done. And Pardon was better, we reckoned. His sickness was passing away. So he went to the post for the second and principal heat of the day. They're off and away with a rattle, like dogs from the leashes let slip. And right at the back of the battle, he followed them under the whip. They gained 10 good lengths and in quickly, he dropped right away from the pack. I tell you, it made me feel sickly to see the blue jacket fall back. Our very last hope had departed. We thought the old fellow was done when all of a sudden he started to go like a shot from a gun. His chances seemed slight to embolden our hearts, but with teeth firmly set, we thought now or never the old one may reckon with some of them yet. Then loud rose the war cry for Pardon. He swept like the wind down the dip, and over the rise by the garden, the jockey was done with the whip. The field were at 6s and 7s, the pace at the first had been fast, and hope seemed to drop from the heavens, for Pardon was coming at last. And how he did come, it was splendid. He gained on the yards every bound, stretching out like a greyhound extended, his girth laid right down the ground. The shimmer of silk and the cedars, as into the running they wheeled, and out flashed the whips on the leaders, for Pardon had collared the field. Then right through the ruck he came sailing. I knew that the battle was won. The son of Haphazard was failing. The Yattendon filly was done. He cut down Don the Dancer. He raced clean away from the mare. He's in front. Catch him now if you can, sir. And up went my hat in the air. Then loud from the lawn and on the garden rose offers of 10 to 1 on. You'll bet on the field I back Pardon. No use, or the money was gone. He came for the third, head light-hearted, a-jumping and dancing about. The others were done ere they started, crestfallen and tired and worn out. He won it and ran it much faster than even the first, I believe. Oh, he was the daddy, the master, Miss Pardon, the son of reprieve. He showed him the method to travel. The boy sat as still as a stone. They never could see him for gravel. He came in hard-handed and alone. But he's old, and his eyes are grown hollow, like me with my thatch of the snow. When he dies, then I hope I may follow and go where the racehorses go. I don't want no harping nor singing. Such things with my style don't agree. Where the hooves of the horses are ringing, there's music sufficient for me. And surely the thoroughbred horses will rise up again and begin fresh races on faraway courses, and perhaps they might let me slip in. It would look rather well, the race card on, amongst cherubs and seraphs and things. Angel Harrison's black belt in Pardon, blue halo, white body and wings. And if they have racing hereafter, and who is to say they will not, when the cheers and the shouting and laughter proclaim that the battle grows hot. As they come down the race course of steering, you'll rush to the front, I believe, and you'll hear the great multitude cheering for pardon, the son of reprieve, end pardon.
Nothing.
I remember this. Now, this was depicting, this was depicting a race they no longer run, isn't it? Wasn't one of those.
Yeah.
What a
bandstanding sort of poem that is. That's just a brilliant poem. And the pardon is mentioned in of course the great banjo Otis Catter. And so if you go to the Man from Snowy River, you'll find pardon in that poem. So that in many ways, that's the precursor poem to A Man from Snowy River.
Like,
yeah, I remember when you read it. It either was right when we started our shows here, or it was right at the end of the last gig.
Now, imagine how excited I was to learn that I had brought one he'd never heard of. That was like when you can find a poem this great by somebody's favorite poet. I considered that a pretty good coup that day, just saying.
Yeah. I sort of got, you heard me when I first read it there, but I was like, I was quite emotional when I got to the end of it because it's such a brilliant poem, you know.
It's like a made-for-TV movie poem type of thing. It's just got everything. It's got the drama, the multiple climaxes, the amazing, amazing end that just leaves you in awe. And to keep that rhyme and flow and interest in how many... I mean, look at all them stanzas. I mean,
probably.
Impressive.
Yeah.
Impressive.
It's just a brilliant poem, Deb. So thank you for bringing it to my attention. And I was going to finish with one of my poems, but I'm not going to now. I've changed my mind. I am going to finish with my new favourite poem, which is by Oojuru Noonical. And it's called Ballad of the Totems. You know this one, Deb. And it goes a little bit like this. My father was a Noonical man and kept the old tribal way. His totem was the carpet snake, whom none must ever slay. But mother was of the Peewee clan, and loudly she expressed the daring view that carpet snakes were nothing but a pest. Now one lived inside with us in full immunity, for no one dared to interfere with father's stern decree. A mighty fellow 10 feet long, and as we lay in bed, we kids could watch him round a beam not far above our head. Only the dog was scared of him, and we'd hear his whines and growls. But mother fiercely hated him because he took her fowls. You should have heard a diatribe that flowed in angry torrents with words you'd never see in print, except in D.H. Lawrence. I'll kill that robber, she would scream, fierce as a spotted cat. You see that bulge inside of him, my speckly hen made that. But father's loud and strict command made even mother quake. I think he'd sooner kill a man than kill a carpet snake. That reptile was a greedy guts, and as each bulge digested, he'd come down on the hunt at night as appetite suggested. We heard his stealthy slithering sound across the earthen floor while the dog gave a startled yelp and bailed it out the door. Then over in the chicken yard, hysterical fowls gave tongue, loud frantic squawks accompanied by the barking of the mung, until at last the racket passed, and then to solve the riddle, next morning he was back up there with a new bulge in the middle. When Father died, we wailed and cried. Our grief was deep and sore. And strange to say, from that sad day, the snake was seen no more. The wise old men explained to us it was his tribal brother, and that is why it's done a guy. But some looked hard at Mother. She seemed to have a secret smile. Her eyes were smug and wary. She looked about as innocent as the cat that ate the pet canary. We never knew, but anyhow, to end this tragic rhyme, I think we hoard snake for tea one day about that time. End poem.
Awesome.
I love it.
Love it with.
AP, are you familiar with Patty won't be at work today? Have you heard that?
Who won't be at work?
Why Patty won't be at work today? I think is what it's called.
No, I'm not. Heather, I'm not. Should I be?
Something came up. It's quite amusing. I don't know if we're running out of time or Deb. How are you feeling?
No, wait. No, the microphone's yours.
Oh, I got no eyes.
Patty, P-A-D-D-Y. Patty.
Patty, yeah, P-A-D-D-Y. Or Patty will not be at work.
Okay.
It says it's a song.
Yeah, it's a song, but it can be just lyrics. Put the lyrics. Unless we can load it and play it. Would that take too long?
Well, I was gonna say, Deb, if we've actually got on the board. A classic Australian song for me by a classic Australian performer. So I'm just going down to find that while you're looking up that one for Hatter. So bear with me.
Videos also of the song.
And Deb.
It's called The Sick Note Hatter.
Why Patty's not at work today?
Yeah, that's like a subtitle.
Right.
But like,
I pull it up. It shows me a bunch of videos. Why Patty?
Okay.
That's the name of the song.
Okay. No, I don't know it, Hatter. I don't know it. But I can tell you what have you found, Deb?
It says the sick note, Why Patty's Not at Work Today by Pat Cooksey. Have you heard it before? Do you know if it starts out, Dear Sir, I write this note to tell you of my plight. Throughout the time of writing, I'm not pretty sight. Yes, that's it.
Can we load the song? Would that take too long?
No, it won't take too long. Let me find this one.
We can do that. Because what we can do, I'll play the Slim Dusty song now, Deb, while you're loading that song, and then we'll come back and do that one. Yeah? So, Waltzing Matilda, great Australian tune, written by banjo. And Slim Dusty was a classic Australian guitarist and singer. And so this is his version of Waltzing Matilda.
Once a jolly swagman camped by a billabong under the shade of a coolabah tree. He sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. He sang as he watched and waited till his billy boiled. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Down came a jumbuck to drink at the billabong. Up jumped the swagman and grabbed him with glee. He sang as he shoved that chumbuck in his tucker bag. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. He sang as he shoved that chumbuck in his tucker bag. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Up rode the squatter, mounted on his thoroughbred. Up rode the troopers, 1, 2, 3. With the jolly jumbuck that you got in your tucker bag, you'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. With the jolly jumbuck that you got in your tucker bag, you'll come a waltzing, you scoundrel, with me. Up jumped the swagman, sprang into the billabong. You'll never take me alive, said he. And his ghost may be heard as you pass by that billabong. You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda. You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. His ghost may be heard as you pass by that billabong. You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with everybody. Waltzing Matilda. Come a waltzing Matilda with me.
There we go. That was fun. Love a bit of old Slim Dusty. Deb, how have you been going with the task you've been set?
It's already in there. It was cool that we played that because, from what I understand, it was written by Banjo Patterson as well. So it was a good segue from.
It was. It was. Poem. And if you look up on the Theme of Voices board, you'll see the original written lyrics of Waltzing Matilda in longhand by Banjo.
Very cool.
So that's in the official Australian archives.
I was going to say, I think I asked you once if that was yours, and you were like, I wish.
No. It's only probably worth 20 or $30 million or something fair like that. You know,
yeah,
not be worth much.
It's only a national treasure,
sorry.
But...
No, it's only a national treasure. It's only the National Archives, piece of sheet of paper. It's anyway. Now, Deb, tell me about this next one, and where do I find it?
It should be, if you refresh, it should be at the very top.
Yep.
Screaming at you, actually. And I'm trying to see if there is anything. It says Pat Cooksey is the songwriter. They are an Irish singer-songwriter, and they wrote it.
So this is the...
Yep. They wrote the song or the poem in humor, and
yep.
I think a little bit of a giggle might be a fun way to end.
Okay.
And that
so this is
was born in 1985.
And this is called The Sick Note for Hatter on the list, yeah?
Yes, and if you look at the chat wall, we can read along while they sing.
Oh, cool. Excellent. Very, very good. Excellent. Okay, great stuff. Okay. So let's finish with that. And thank you to Deb for all the hard work she did putting the
Ford together and all those things together, and reminding me to do a Banjo Patterson song. And my thanks to Hatter for being along for the journey as well. And to all my fellow Australians out there, have a great Australia Day, even though it, you know, we've got to have an Australia Day at some point. And might as well celebrate it while it's there as it is. Let's hope that when we have this show next year, that we've got further forward on making sure to get at least something together on a treaty. So, okie doke. With that, I am going to play this piece, Hatter, and we will see each other in a few days on the weekend. And our topic you chose this week. So, what was the topic again? Help me, Hatter.
Little acts of kindness.
Random acts of kindness. Acts of kindness.
Random acts of kindness. So that's for Saturday night. Deb, did you want to say anything about the shows coming up in the next few days?
Well, actually, tomorrow's Hatter at 9.
Yes.
I believe Sweet Democratic co-host, and they are featuring Meatloaf. Rest in peace.
Okay. Fantastic.
Great information, AP.
So thank you to everybody. Thanks, Deb. And thank you to Hatter. And we are out with this piece, Hatter, that you requested. And we will catch you in a few days' time. Talk to everybody soon. Bye.
Sick note.
Here we go.
Dear sir, I write this note to you to tell you of me plight. And at the time of writing, I am not a pretty sight. Me body is all black and blue, me face a deathly grey, and I write this note to say why Paddy's not at work today. While working on the 14th floor, some bricks I had to clear. Now to throw them down from such a height, it was not a good idea. The foreman wasn't very pleased, he being an awkward sod. He said I'd have to cart them down, the ladder's in me hod. Now, clearing all these bricks by hand, it was so very slow. So I hoisted up a barrel and secured the rope below. But in me haste to do the job, I was too blind to see that a barrel full of building bricks was heavier than me. So when I untied the rope, the barrel fell like lead. And clinging tightly to the rope, I started up instead. Well, I shot up like a rocket, till to my dismay I found that halfway up I met the bloody barrel coming down. Well, the barrel broke me shoulder as to the ground it sped. And when I reached the top, I banged the pulley with me head. Well, I clung on tight, though numbed with shock from this almighty blow. And the barrel spilled out half the bricks 14 floors below. Now, when these bricks had fallen from the barrel to the floor, I then outweighed the barrel and so started down once more. Still clinging tightly to the rope, I sped towards the ground, and I landed on the broken bricks that were all scattered round. Well, I lay there groaning on the ground, I thought I'd passed the worst, when the barrel hit the pulley wheel and then the bottom burst. Well, a shower of bricks rained down on me, I hadn't got a hope. As I lay there moaning on the ground, I let go the bloody rope. The barrel then being heavier, it started down once more, and landed right across me as I lay upon the floor. Well, it broke three ribs and my left arm, and I can only say, but I hope you'll understand why Paddy's not at work today.
Impressive. Thank you, Hatter. Thank you, everybody. We'll catch you on Saturday night and for Random Acts of Kindness. And bye, everybody. Thanks for joining in.
See you guys.
Thanks, Hatter. Bye, Deb.